Seen and foreseen consequences of organophosphate and carbamate insecticide losses for nursery plant production.
Thank you.
Well, I feel a little bit like Susan Fisher this morning talking about DDT and what's going on. And again, I guess what really precipitated this, when I first got some correspondence that this session was going on, in Ohio, our nursery producers had just learned that glutathione was disappearing. And this has been a major component for their black vine weevil control programs, and they were wondering what they were going to do. And we said, oh, well, there's plenty of stuff out there to control black vine weevils. And they said, Bug Doc, you don't understand. All those other things cost a lot of money. And so what I'd like to present today are, I think, some of the consequences that may be going on here. I guess first, what is the real issue here? Obviously, I think that we're seeing a lot of secondary breakout of the implementation of the FQPA Act with EPA. Basically, this was, as far as I can tell, what it was really set up to do was to stop exposure of young children and pregnant women and so forth from being exposed to various pesticides. And obviously, by doing that, what we've done is restricted and removed many of the organophosphates and carbamates, and primarily the reason why we've done that, they're the first ones that have gone through this review. And for those of you that are in the know, the pyrethroids are also on the block, and we're going to lose a lot of our pyrethroids very soon. At least my contacts with EPA have indicated that risk cup is way overflowing and something needs to be done about it. So I think some of the basic issues that we need to be thinking about on these are number one, some economics of this, and we'll talk about that. Have we improved our environmental safety, or are we still having some environmental safety issues? Are replacement insecticides, do they have the same pest spectrum? I find it amusing that we call some of these new neonicotinoids broad-spectrum insecticides, and when you look at the label, you go, well, where's the broad spectrum compared to something like Durzban? We also need to talk about resistance management. If we switch chemistries and actually remove entire categories of chemistries, have we really strengthened our ability to do pest resistance management, or have we lessened that? Also, I think there are some issues about IPM. Some of these new insecticides especially really don't fit into our old paradigms of IPM, and I know many of you are working on trying to redefine and change what we talk about in IPM, but I think there are some definite consequences for those. To give you an example of some of the economics, I find that if you do some comparisons of costs of these, and I know we as scientists say, you know, cost be damned, we don't care about that, but the reality is these growers do. They are tracking how much it costs to produce a particular plant in some acreage, and if you take a look at these, some of the good old things, things like carbaryl and trichlorophan, for a quarantine pest such as the white grub, we're talking at $50 an acre or less, and they feel that they can probably take that on. On the other hand, if we take a look at imidacloprid, the commercial product that's registered for nursery production, if you actually use it at the effective rate, we're talking at over $1,000 per acre for that. And of course, I keep wondering, why are you not using these neonicotinoids to manage their grubs? And obviously, if you take a look at the economics of that, it's incredible. Fortunately, since imidacloprid has gone off patent, we are seeing some secondary products coming into that market, and it's lowering the cost. When I put this together, the offshore cost of imidacloprid per acre is at $40 an acre. I just found out recently that it's dropped down to $18 an acre. But the real problem with that, again, is that we do need nurseries on those labels, and some of these labels are not showing up with nurseries. Many of you have probably heard of Celeprin, the new chloramphenylprol material, very effective for grub management and so forth. But what I can tell, at least in the turf market, that's running about $160 to $170 an acre in the turf market. We don't see or haven't seen what a nursery production would be for that, but my feeling is if it's like what we saw with the neonicotinoids, the companies that are marketing these will be charging a premium for that. Now let's take a look at another very difficult pest to manage. This one is not necessarily a major quarantine pest, but an actual pest of plant production in this system. We've been using in the past acephate or orthene for knocking down the adults' populations, and then our good old Goo-Thion. I know many of you are aware that that's a Category 1 insecticide, pretty hot material. But if you take a look at the cost of that, we're talking $16 an acre to accomplish fairly good black vine weevil manage for that. Furadan was used in the past, mainly as a planting material, and again, that was pretty inexpensive. If we take a look at the Tolstars or bifenthrins, which are again used primarily either as a pot mix and does very well there, but in the field it's primarily to knock down the adult populations, obviously getting more expensive. And then I've always wondered why our nursery producers in Ohio don't use imidacloprid. We do know that it's very effective in managing these grubs, but again, if you take a look at the economics of it, it's obvious why they were really complaining about the potential loss of Goo-Thion or Azinfos methyl. Well, we take a look at some of the environmental safety issues. I think, again, we have some things that we really need to keep in mind with this. Number one, is, as far as I'm concerned, the acreage is really relatively small. We're not talking about large acreage in nursery production. And so even though we might be using materials that we would say would be unsafe in a normal urban habitat, we're using this in smaller acreages. Also, one of the factors that we do need to be aware of is that some of the new insecticides, as well as many of the old insecticides, did pose some groundwater and ground contamination issues. And even though many of the nurseries are now going to ground covers and turf in between their areas, we do still have a lot of these pesticides being applied to groundwater. We also have non-target effects. I'll cover those, what I call secondary pest effects. And obviously, in order to keep costs down in these nurseries, we do have a lot of untrained workers. And again, we've implemented the normal worker protection standards in these areas. And so we do have to be cognizant that if we do retain some of the organophosphates, carbamates, and the rest of them, we really need to make sure that we keep these untrained workers out of those fields until the acute toxicity is moved off. Well, again, what I wanted to sort of illustrate with this picture, this is a typical urban habitat, and again, I somewhat dispute some of the contentions that I see that this is nothing but a green desert. It's being inundated with pesticides, but I think it's very clear if you take a close look at these landscapes. In reality, all of the data that I've been able to come up with indicates that only about 30 to 40% of the landscapes in our urban habitats receive some kind of a pesticide or fertilizer application every year. And if you don't believe that, just look at this patchwork quilt. You'll see the green ones, and you'll see the brown ones, and you'll see the really brown ones. And typically, the brown ones and the really brown ones haven't received either fertilizer or pesticides on there. And so, again, I think the actual risk has been somewhat overblown, even in our urban habitats, for the reasons why we removed some of these organophosphates, carbamates, and soon the pyrethroids. This is the reality in some of the nursery production. This is obviously an upscale nursery where they've have a very high maintenance of the land in between the tree rows. And in this particular area, what they are most concerned for in here are three basic problems with the plants. Obviously, they need to manage the pests that could outright kill those plants, and we're seeing some problems with those. More importantly to many of these nursery producers is aesthetics. They have to sell this plant to somebody. And just like it was indicated earlier in a greenhouse talk, they're going to get that plant sent back. If it has a pest on it or the buyer detects that, and I hear this all the time from the nursery producers, they say, well, we'd like to sell these, we'd like to implement IPM, we'd like to keep biological controls on it, but my purchaser is saying it's got a pest on it. I'll take it if you sell it to me half price. And so, again, there's a lot of economics going on in this. And of course, in this particular case, where they're looking for the white grubs in here, we have quarantine issues. And again, I think moving to some of these new pesticides may not solve some of the quarantine issues or keep those quarantine issues in check. When we talk about the non-targets, I think we can all agree that there are definite effects of both the old traditional pesticides, our organophosphates, carbamates, pyrethroids, and we're now beginning to find there are also non-target effects on the beneficials of even some of our new chemistry. And so that is going to be the reality in nursery production. In order to produce a pest-free plant, we're going to have collateral damage going on with that. What I'm finding interesting is that now we're beginning to remove organophosphates and carbamates from the nurseries. We're finding what we used to call secondary pests or very occasional pests coming back in. And one of the big groups of this that I'm seeing both in our urban landscapes and also in the nursery production are the aerophyid mites. Most of these new insecticides, the neonicotinoids especially, have absolutely no effect on these. And so I think I find it kind of amusing that the collateral damage of using the organophosphates and carbamates, we were keeping these things in check, nobody was noticing them. Now that they've disappeared, these secondary pests are resurging and now becoming primary pests. Well, if we take a look at the acute toxicity, I hate to give credit to any government agency. However, the true reality, I think, and this is partially a good story that we need to be keeping in mind, through the Food Quality Protection Act, the chemical manufacturers, the people that are in basic research discovering new molecules, have now determined that they really need to be looking at alternate products. And so if we take a look at the organophosphates and the carbamates, you know, we were using some pretty hot stuff. And here I am trying to say we need to save glutathione, azofosmethyl, and you look at that and holy cripe, you know, we'd be in a moon suit out there. And in reality, if you're using that, you do need to be in a moon suit in order to use that type of a product. If we also take a look at the carbamates, we've used some pretty hot material in our nurseries. Carbofuran, obviously a Category 1 skull and crossbones type of material. And when I'm explaining this to homeowners and lay people, they always say, hey, Dave, could you go back to that one with the Dursban and Diaznon? Isn't that more toxic than carbaryl? Why do we still have carbaryl on the shelf? And the reality is I point out that this is really an oversimplification. There are other things that EPA looks at where carbaryl is not readily absorbed through the skin. Something like a Dursban is very readily absorbed through the skin. And so it's really other things that may cause a cancellation or a removal from the industry. Also, I find it many lay people say, well, it's good that we're using the pyrethroids because they're less toxic. But in reality, if you look at them as a full category, the toxicities of these are medium to low toxicity molecules, very similar to the organophosphates and carbamates. I think, as I mentioned before, the good story on this, if we take a look at the potential alternate products that we're recommending that these nursery producers use, such as the neonicotinoids, we're finding, or at least I find it kind of ironic, that the first one out of the chute, imidacloprid, is actually a medium toxicity material. And it's been the later neonicotinoids that have been brought to the market that have some very interesting niche fit areas are things like clothianidin, methoxamine, dinotefuran. These are getting into the very low toxicity area. What's even more interesting is something like clothianidin. If you take a look at that one, the actual 100% active ingredient has an LD50 of over 5,000, which would legally put that in category 4 of the EPA categories of practically non-toxic. However, they had to put in surfactants and spreader and stickers. And so the formulated product of clothianidin, the clothianidin 50 water dispersible granule, actually has an LD50 of 3,500. So in this case, the inert ingredients, unlike in the past with our organophosphates and carbamates, where we put inert ingredients that actually make it less toxic, this is one where the inert ingredients made it more toxic. Also, we were hearing some of the other alternate materials, the spinosads and azadirachtins. Again, these are very low toxicity materials, but again, I contend that many of these, because of the spectrum of activity that they have, really are not good replacements for some of the organophosphates and carbamates that we've had in the past. If we take a look at down this list, notice that there are some real outstanding ones here. Obviously, fipronil, which has reached the market. I think most of you probably have cats or dogs that have had flea spots on them, and you're going, holy cripe, I didn't realize that I was dosing my cat or dog with something like that. But again, this brings about one of the other dictums in toxicology. It's the dose that makes the poison. And in this case, we use fipronil at extremely low rates. In some of the areas in turf, we're using it at 0.003 pounds of active ingredient per acre. On the other hand, the newest kid on the block, the anthralic diamides, or acelaprin, this is a material that's got our environmentalist friends very upset. Because DuPont was able to put inert ingredients in this one that kept the material, even the formulated product, over 5,000, and it even states at the bottom, key word or signal word not needed. So it's going to be interesting to see how people react to a new insecticide that has no warning type of words on it. Well, when I talk about the pest spectrum, one of the things I wanted to point out with is obviously I picked Dursban here. That's the one that has a book as a label. And if you distill this out, we can see that the spectrum of insects that are hit by this is extremely broad, very large. And if you compare that with our other so-called broad-spectrum insecticide, like imidacloprid, you'll see that really imidacloprid or the merit-like materials are probably only about a third the number of critters. And there's some obvious missing components in here. And the missing component that is most concerned to many of my nursery producers are the Lepidoptera. How do I kill the Lepidopterous borers? If we take a look at some of these targets, we find these new neonicotinoids are very good against certain pests that work very well, many of the sucking pests, certain dipter groups, and obviously the hymenopterous groups. They also have some key components in certain scales. We see, at least with imidacloprid, soft scales work very well. And if you're a coleopterous borer, other than a bark beetle, also most of these neonicotinoids do a very good job. On the other hand, we have to also be cognizant that if I'm in a nursery production setting, when I used to be using something like one of the organophosphates or carbamates, I was getting near 100% control of my white pine weevil, but if I use something like imidacloprid for white pine weevil, we're averaging about 80% control. So I'm going to lose 20% of the tops of those conifers in my production. Likewise, there's a lot of things that are missing in nursery production. We have major problems with the tip dwarf mites in the production of our junipers and arborvitae in Ohio. And realistically, the Saigon products and those materials were doing a very good job on this. And right now, if those disappear, we have no replacements for those. Also, I have some of the Lepidopterous borer pests in here. We are finding that some of the neonicotinoids can kind of wound these, but it's not the kind of control or the level of controls that we had with some of our organophosphates. When we get into insecticide and miticide resistance, I think we also need to be aware that as we narrow the number of chemical categories, there will always be those pests that are very susceptible to developing resistance or are prone to developing resistance. These things are also nursery production pests, and we need to be aware of that they're going to be out there. I think to sort of wrap this up, one of the final things that I would like to point out is in integrated pest management. We've always imposed in integrated pest management the concept of monitoring, and once we monitor and we reach an economic level or a threshold level, we would then apply the insecticide. And the reality is our new chemistry will not allow us to do this. You cannot get curative control of many of the insects with the neonicotinoids and also with things like acelaprin. Even though we've moved to plant health care, a lot of people are saying, well, we need to spend more time with plant health care. The reality, again, plant health care, basically, we're looking at the plant and its health, and it's not until something begins to go awry that we then want to do a curative intervention with this. And many of these new pesticides do not allow that. And so, again, I challenge that our new pesticides don't really fit into many of the core IPM thinking of monitoring the pests, waiting till we reach a threshold, and then also using them very sparingly to conserve the biological and cultural controls. Basically, the neonicotinoids and the anthracnide diamides are best used as preventives. And what will happen is sort of a rhetorical question when our curative insecticides are no longer available for us. In summary, I think we are victims of our own history and our prejudices with pesticides. Most of us have experienced the major environmental problems caused by the overuse of some of these early pesticide groups, and the group's propensity themselves to force pests to become resistant when we overuse them. The successes of these early pesticides also caused us to abandon the use of biological and cultural mechanical controls, and that's why we implemented IPM. And the question is, to me, will our current crop of pesticides, these new pesticides, will they have the same problems, and how can we use them in redefining IPM? Well, I think I heard the little buzzer over here, and if we've got time for a question or two or a comment, I'll be glad to try to field those. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions, because for those that were not here at the beginning, our next speaker was unable to attend, so we actually have a break until 3:10 after questions here.
Yes, question?
I'm actually coming from north of the border, and we're, of course, going through some of the same regulations, things that you guys are. And I'm just kind of curious, and Susan, if you probably know a little bit more about this, what does it look like for the EPA for doing, say, getting rid of some of these extra things like carbaryl, because I know that one is up for...
Carbaryl is being reviewed. Yeah, the question is basically from north of the border where they're experiencing losses of chemistry is also what sort of EPA strategy. I guess my feeling is EPA doesn't care. That is not their goal. Their goal is to sort of create a better environment and habitats, and so they have different strategies. And I really don't have a complaint with that in residential areas. I think has already been demonstrated. We can find alternate materials. We can remodify our urban habitats using resistant plant materials and so forth. But in production areas, it's actually one of the things I wanted to mention earlier, this is actually an unintended consequence, and it really is economics with the chemical companies too, that if they can't sell these products or enough of these products, it no longer supports the factory that has to produce these products. And so we're actually seeing losses of these molecules for two reasons. Once the production costs go way up as the amount is reduced, and number two, EPA says, well, if you still want to use this stuff, it's going to cost you $5 million to resubmit the data package on this. Oh, and we're sorry that it's gone off patent, and once you've spent that money, anybody can buy it and sell it then. And so that's another unintended consequence of losing these. Question in the back?
You talked about, you know, losing some of these things and how mites are seeing some insects that have been controlled now flaring up. But I've talked to a lot of growers that are using something like bifenthrin and container grown stock.
Yes.
They've been able to eliminate a lot of sprays for secondary pest outbreaks that were caused by their weevil control program?
Yes, the comment is by using some of the remaining insecticides in different ways or novel ways, and not doing these cover sprays of everything with these cheap insecticides that we're seeing a resurgence of the biological controls and other things coming into that. I agree with that. We're seeing that also, that we're seeing a lot of the biological controls coming in and doing things. But again, one of the unintended consequences of that, what our growers are having to do is just before they sell the plant, they have to nuke it to get rid of everything and anything that might be on it that would be a reduction in the sell price to their customer, because their customer is looking at it and say, it's got a scale on it, or it's got this on it, I can't buy it, or I'll buy it at a reduced rate from you. Dave?
In relation to the area of fire, are you aware of anything related to what they're showing with the Tetra Nickets on fecundity and neonicotinoids? And then number two, are all the area of fire a problem, per se, as a pest?
The question is, have we seen any data on increased fecundity with the area fides from some of these new chemistries? Basically, what I don't see any documentation for that. We obviously are seeing a rebound of some of the spider mite populations, but it's not like what carbaryl did with spider mites. It acted sort of as a sex stimulant, and the females produce more eggs than normal. We're not seeing that. It's been pretty well documented with the neonicotinoids. What we're doing is we're eliminating some of the predators that we were unaware that actually are feeding on plant material that contains imidacloprid. They're taken out, and then the spider mites can flare up. There's nothing to control them in that. But I sort of look at it. We've had these kinds of issues with all the previous chemistries and all it does is alert us that we can't just substitute a new chemistry for an old chemistry, because there's issues even with the new chemistries of what will go on with those and how they'll control the pests. My feeling with the areophyids, many of these, especially the foliage feeding areophyids, the rust mites, we were controlling very well. And now, to give an example, the hemlock rust mite in our nursery production area is probably the number one pest now in hemlock behind Fletcher scale. I didn't mention Fletcher scale during my earlier session here. We actually now are afraid that we may have some resistance of Fletcher scale to the neonicotinoids, because where they were getting very good control of that about 5 years ago, they're now getting very poor control with neonicotinoids on Fletcher scale. Well,
actually, I have a question.
Oh, okay, yes.
And I hadn't really thought about this until your talk, but throughout the southern U.S., galls becoming more and more of an issue, especially under live oaks. I'm almost wondering if maybe that's changing some of the practices. Is anything gall-wise in Ohio?
The question is, have we seen any increases in the galls? And yes, we're seeing that. We're seeing both galls that have been caused by the areophyid mites, but also the cynipid galls. And my feeling is some of the earlier materials, especially things like the Saigon and those materials, I think the secondary effect of that is that was taking out many of these internal pests. And likewise, we found out that was one of the reasons why we found out that we were getting very good control of the areophyid mites that caused the tip dwarf stunning. We were just sort of taking those out. People weren't aware of it. Now that we've removed those, we're getting a lot of complaints that, our junipers don't look like they used to look. And what's going on here, and the replacements, we don't have good systemic miticides that will take those things out that are really tucked down into the plant material. Yes, Clay?
Yeah, when you talked about resistance management, Dave, I wonder, some of these insects might sell one or two generations a year. How big a concern is resistance management? And when you look at the products, do we have enough different modes of action for the nursery producers to do rotation programs to minimize that?
Right, and that's one of the major concerns I have. What we're seeing with these, the secondary effect of some of these neonicotinoids is they're in the plant, cross generations of some of these pests, and so In the past, where we had these organophosphates and carbamates that would disappear within a generation, and so you could rotate in the next generation of the pest with a different chemistry, now we're seeing carryover between generations. And I'm really worried. Like I said, I was talking to Whitney Cranshaw, and they feel that they have a problem out in Colorado where they've got the European elm scale. They had no problems. Everybody was treating every elm with a neonicotinoid, and now they're finding that scale is resurging and coming back even after treatments. And, you know, he hasn't done the studies yet, but he suspects there may be some resistance already to that from overuse of these new insecticides. Yes?
Dave, is there any chance of a lot of these insects becoming super insects? And I'm thinking more of mites and two-spotted mites. Never have we had more modes of action to control mites, but production growers, ornamental growers are saying they can't get any.
Yeah, I don't know if they're super critters or whether we've just not figured out how to best use our new chemistry. You know, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I can kill caterpillars with imidacloprid, but it requires a lot of pre-thinking to have the maximum amount of that molecule in the leaf at the time that the caterpillar takes its first bite. And you know, that's a factor of how fast it's taken up, how far fast it's transported, and when it reaches that zenith of its level. But if I hit it too early or too late, and I'm not at that peak amount of material in the leaf, I don't get any caterpillar control. And so I think these chemistries, as far as I'm concerned, are so new. We've rushed them into the markets, and we've been pleased with what they've done, but I think we need a lot of basic research to really go back in and look at some of the other nuances of them. Well, I hate to occupy the whole time here. I know we have some other issues with this group that we might want a general discussion on. Thank you again.